Welcome, everyone, here in Galbreath Chapel and online. We have a number of friends online, and we're so glad to have you with us. We are delighted to begin a four-part series with Jim Davison and Sandy Connolly, helping us to see four gospel stories through Rembrandt's eyes. So please join me in welcoming Jim and Sandy.
Well, hi guys. Good to see you. Are people online today?
Oh, yeah.
Well, up there somewhere. Somebody, all of you as well.
Some of your good friends are online.
Yeah, that's what I would guess. Well, anyway, it's really good to be back. It's always nice to come here and see old friends. I should say longtime friends. And from the Gospels and other places and things like that. So let's start with a word of prayer. Our gracious God, we give you thanks this day once again for your giving us another day, a day to live in this world that you have created. A day to share with one another, a day to worship you, a day to learn. We pray that you might be with us at this time and through the whole of our time here at Westminster today, that we might be strengthened and enriched and drawn closer to your Son, Jesus Christ. We pray it in his name. Amen. Well, before we actually start, I wanted to mention just a few things. And actually, oh, yeah, that's right. I'm doing this. I forgot. We've done this both ways at various times. But three comments just to describe where this comes from and why we're doing it. First is simply my own initial interest. As Dan said to me, I didn't know you did anything with art. I said, I don't. However, when I went to the Netherlands to do graduate work in Amsterdam, first week I was there, I went to the Rijksmuseum, as any good visitor should do, and there were paintings by Rembrandt. I had heard his name, I knew a little bit about him, but while I was there, I came to really love his paintings and what he can do. A few, not the paintings, but a few little photographs and other things, prints, have decorated my office and my home ever since. And what always intrigued me when I saw what he had to say, what he had to paint, really, was how he could put action into a scene, otherwise a static scene, but that somehow it had movement in it. That's what really first struck me. And also then how he could focus on a particular point that was really central to whatever he was doing. He did many different kinds of things, but often he did biblical passages, Old Testament, a lot of the stories, all the way through the Old Testament to the time of Jesus, and then many things in the Gospels and other things, the Apostle Paul and so forth. And so, along with that, of course, he was making a living and he painted portraits of the rich and the famous back at the time. They didn't have to be famous, but if they were rich, he would be happy to paint their picture because many of them wanted them. This is a self-portrait here that you see that he did of himself. He did a series of them. So you can kind of see how he grows and changes through the course of his life. This one is housed at the Frick collection in New York City, but it was here on in a show, right? Some of you were there. And this past summer at the Frick, I happened to have a chance to go to it. I was planning to go, and I suddenly realized the time is almost up. I've got to get there. So I found a day that I could go, and I got there. And lo and behold, I discovered some of you people from Westminster coming at the same time, basically. It was a nice providential touch, you might say. He's 52 years old at this point in 1658. But if you look at I gave you a basic little outline of his bio. just so you have that to look at it some other time. We're not going to really use it directly, but if you read through it at some point, you'll notice a variety of things that kind of bring his life to light. And one of them is this date, actually, 1658. When you look at that painting, doesn't he look regal, well off, well fed? He has gained quite a bit of weight. That was a popular thing to do through much of history, just because that indicated that you were well fed and you had the money to buy food. We have more money than we need to buy food, let's put it that way. But in any case, he looks fine, but he's actually just finished bankruptcy proceedings. And the effect of that, of course, means he had virtually nothing at the time. But that's not how he looks when he painted himself. So I don't really know, and I didn't see anybody actually talking about it, but either he is wanting to remember where he was and wants to think in terms of what he really is, even though he now no longer has finances and so forth, or it's kind of like a joke. Here I am bankrupt, but I'm going to paint myself like I'm at the top of the world. I don't really know. I haven't seen it. So, but it's fascinating that he did that. The second thing is that this whole class is a kind of, it's the title of the class and the idea for it came to me through doing a riff on this book by an art historian named Simon Schema. Rembrandt's Eyes, it's called. That's a title that's intriguing and draws you in. It's a fairly big book, as you see. It's heavy and dense in the sense of how many words are in it. So unfortunately, I have never gotten around to reading the whole thing. But just so you know, that's where the title comes from. And it did occur to me that if one of you would like to read it in the next couple of weeks, you're welcome to take it with you. No one's even smiling. The third thing is, as I put this thought, this is what I want to do. It dawned on me, boy, it would be really wonderful to have a friend who is an artist help me out here. And that's how Sandy has become involved. Thank you, Sandy. I thought she could talk a little bit about the paintings and the structure of them, things like that, as then I deal with the gospel passage and how it relates to the painting, more or less. So we'll be doing this back and forth a little bit. There are two paintings we'll look at today related to the prodigal son. The title, The Return of the Prodigal Son, comes from the second painting. It's the more significant in a way, but you really need to see the first one in order to get a sense for that. So all that's background. You'll see I also gave you a sheet with the passage, the actual proverb or parable that Jesus presented to an audience back in that time. And it's recorded in Luke 15. And my plan now is that I'll read the parable, and I would like you just to look along at it. And as you look at it, though, think about the question, what would I focus on if I were Rembrandt? What would I make the central point, spot at which I would make my focus? There can be all kinds of answers to that, and none of them are wrong. But I just like you to think that way as we read it. So we'll read it. I'm going to read the first side. There's two sides to it, but I'm going to read the first side to begin with. Then Jesus said, there was a man who had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the wealth that belongs to me. So he divided his assets between them. A few days later, the younger son gathered all that he had, and he traveled to a distant region. And there, he squandered his wealth in dissolute living. When he had spent everything, a severe famine took place throughout that region, and he began to be in need. So he went and he hired himself out to one of the citizens of that region, who sent him to his fields to feed his pigs. He would gladly have filled his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. But when he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired hands have bread enough and to spare? But here I am dying of hunger. I will get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired hands.' So he set off and he went to his father. But while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. And he ran and he put his arms around him and he kissed him. Then the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his slaves, 'Quickly, bring out a robe, the best one, put it on him, put a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet, and get the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and he's found.' And they began to celebrate." So the question is, what did you think? What might you focus on? Just in a brief word. Expect to see a child? The child coming, okay, yeah. Anybody else? The turning point where he realizes where he is among the pigs. There are painters who actually paint that. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would think that the focus is that the fathers and after the
Okay, the fathers and father's compassion. Okay. Okay, well, all of those work, right? And there's actually more than one, there is a central point, and I think you're right at it. But there are a couple of other points as well that become part of it. So we'll see those as we go along. But let's look for a little bit here at that younger son, or the parables. It starts it with it, when it says, a man had two sons. That's actually, we might say, okay, starting point. But that would draw people in instantly who lived at that time. It's an ancient theme, really, of two sons. And guess what? They don't get along, really. So you have Cain and Abel. You have Jacob and Esau, and you have others along the way. And usually there's friction because if there's two sons, the catch in that society was the oldest son got 2/3 of the inheritance. The younger son got 1/3. The older one also got more, he got to carry the family name in a way that the younger son didn't. So to be the younger son is a tough place to be. You're much better off if you're the older son. Now you might wonder, what happens if there's 5, 6, 7 sons? Well, the older son didn't get 2/3. He got half, and the rest divided it. So you can see the difference in status. So this whole idea, right, you can imagine if you're part of the first audience when Jesus preach this parable, your reaction is going to be something along the lines of what? Give me a share of the wealth that will belong to me? This son is asking for that? How does he dare? Some of you might know the name Ken Bailey. New Testament scholar who's died a few years ago now. He spent most of his career teaching in the Middle East, in Lebanon, actually. And he became well accustomed to the cultures over there. He spent his time trying to look at how the gospels particularly relate to that time period, village culture, what it was like then, because that hasn't really changed much over centuries and centuries. And so he went to a number of different countries, actually, and different places he knew, and slightly different traditions among these various people. And he asked the question, what would happen if a younger son did this? And the answer he always got was, oh, no younger son would ever do that. And so he pushed the point and said, well, what if he did? Oh, we would kill him. You might say, well, that's kind of unbelievable. Yeah, really? All right, that's a little much. So I thought it would be useful to notice, if you go back to the books of Moses, the Torah, to Deuteronomy, and you look at a passage in chapter 21, one of the laws, if someone has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey his father and mother, who does not heed them when they discipline him, then they shall take hold of him, bring him out to the elders of the town at the gate. They shall say to the elders, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. Then all the men of the town shall stone him to death. So you shall purge the evil from your midst, and all Israel will hear and be afraid. That's not a new custom. Goes way back. And you have to assume that the people who are hearing the parable, some of them at least, are thinking that's what this kid deserves. Well, the father does divide the property up, though, right? And the younger son then takes off. He gathers everything he has, and he goes to a distant land. You know, not next door. He goes as far away as he can get. He wants nothing to do with the family anymore. It's basically total rejection. And you can imagine how that would feel to the family too, of course, and the reactions that they would have to all of that. But that's what he does. He desires no more contact of any sort. And that's where we're going to jump now to look at the first painting. And so, Sandy, I'd like to call you up here to introduce that one.
Well, good morning, everybody. Good morning. I'm happy to see you all here. Yes, and I'm just going to take maybe 5 minutes or so to talk about this first painting, which, can you hear me? Okay, good. This particular painting of the prodigal son was done at a time when Rembrandt was 29 years old. This was in 1635. And at that time, he was a highly successful and respected 29-year-old. While he never traveled to Italy, by the time he left his home in Leiden. Tell me.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Netherlands, to settle in Amsterdam in 1631. He had already been exposed to the latest developments of Baroque painting. Rembrandt was among the Dutch followers of Caravaggio, who was influenced by Titian. And just to kind of give you a little bit of, some of their characteristics of their paintings, their use of light and shade, dramatic figures filling the picture, and a loosening of brush strokes on the painting surface had become familiar to Rembrandt. And Rembrandt built on what it was that he knew about and valued in their painting styles. So by this time, Rembrandt had abandoned some conventional Dutch smoothness of the painting surface. Instead, he was working with texture created by many layers of paint. One of the distinguishing marks of Rembrandt was his ability to model with a heavily loaded brush. Where others needed 5 touches, he was using one stroke. His painting process was always to begin with a medium brown ground mixed with resin and animal glue. Therefore, he worked from dark to light. Much of the background that you see is largely how it would have been put down at the onset of the painting. He worked in layers, as I said, building up the picture with delicate glazes. And then at the very end, that's when those highlights would happen. And that really gives a luster and a liveness to the paintings. Rembrandt left no preliminary sketches. He worked out the composition on the canvas. So let's talk about the design of this painting. So I think an artist's primary goal, I speak from experience, is to send the viewer on a visual journey around the painting. So let's do that together. I want you to close your eyes and count. I'll count to 5, and then we'll open them. And what I want you to do is see where, after your eyes are closed and you open them, where is your eye first drawn? So let's close our eyes, and I'm going to count to 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now open your eyes, and where is your eye first drawn? In other words, where do you enter the work? So anybody want to share? The father's face. Mine too. Anybody else have a different place where they enter the painting? Carolyn? The sword. Interesting. The hilt of the sword. Interesting. And that's a light part. Isn't that something? Anybody else?
I'm attracted to the lightest part of the painting.
Which is?
Where the hand is and the what? The dress, the bustle, the whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear you. That's what you saw first. Okay. Well, those are all, I think, intentional places that Rembrandt would have, expected people to enter. And he has highlighted all of those particular places. The face, which is where I start. And by the way, that is Rembrandt's face. If you hadn't noticed, it's a younger version of Rembrandt. And the woman actually is his wife, Saskia. She was his model for this painting. They had only been married for about a year. Anyway, so what I see and what works for me, but please, I'd love to hear what you all see. It's a circular thing for me, is that I enter with the face, or you could enter with the hand and work your way up and around a clockwise circle to view this piece. The background recedes, and those highlighted places come forth. And that's a classic Rembrandt way of telling, helping to tell the story is with his design. So what is the mood? I'm going to ask you that question and then throw it back to Jim, because he's going to take us through some other things. But anybody care to share the mood? Yes. Mm-hmm. I do see a smile on her face, which could be, you know, interpreted any number of ways. Right. Anything else? No? Okay. Well, then I'm going to throw this back to Jim. Thank you all.
Thanks, Sandy. Well, that's funny, because I was going to mention, if you look at that, Rembrandt looks really happy. It's almost like he's still on the honeymoon stage and rejoicing. And his wife, within the first year of their marriage, it's kind of like she's thinking, is this what I'm marrying into? I'm being pictured as a prostitute to start with. You know, it's hard. You can't tell exactly, but they apparently had a good relationship. So, and she did serve as a model for him for quite a number of other paintings, not like this one. So anyway, again, if you put yourself in the audience's position and think of this, the way he has done what he's done, he ends up, of course, very quickly ending up where you would expect he would, in dissolute living. And from the joy of it and spending money royally, all of a sudden he's out of money. And you heard the rest of that parable. He ends up feeding pigs at the end of it. Yes. I think just the prodigal son. That's right. Yeah, just the prodigal son, which of course is what he is right at that point. He's not returning or anything. But then there is the real shock here, the first big switch that is not expected, which is he comes to his senses and he realizes how bad his circumstances are. And it's almost like he ends up somehow or other in honest self-reflection and decides it's time to go back. There's nothing here for me. I can't possibly be my father's son again, but maybe he would have some kind of mercy on me and let me not feed pigs, do something a little bit better than that, but be a servant. And so he makes up his mind to go back. And then the text tells us that while he was still far off, as Jesus describes this, and right there, as he was still far off, obviously his father sees him. So it's almost as if his father has been hoping against hope that he might come back. And he's been looking out at the horizon on a regular basis. And then he finally sees him and he rejoices. And again, what a shock that would be to the audience to imagine that the father wants anything to do with him. He should be dead to him. And so he's doing something completely different from what they would expect. But it continues to say he was filled with compassion when he sees his son in that condition, and he runs to him. I like that phrase, because those of you who know me from the old days here, I always have loved to run. Now I would say jog. And I used to do that up on Hastings Mill Road regularly. It's a narrow road, you might say. No. But in any case, there wasn't that much traffic. Or Gilfil and Trail, right up the street here. Running is not something special to us. All kinds of people do it. Boys and girls, adults, women and adult men. It's just typical nowadays for us. But back then, it was exactly the opposite of what any self-respecting man in the village would be doing. Because if you were self-respecting, you would walk in a very stately manner, slowly. You might actually be in a lot of rush, but you would not show that. And so when Jesus says he runs to him, he's basically saying that this father doesn't care about the self-respect he has in the village, how it looks to anybody else. He wants to get to that son. And again, the shock for his hearers would be immense. Well, he gets to him, and the son then says, I have sinned. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But I want to stop for a second and say, listen to that phrase. I'm no longer worthy to be your son. He's right. He isn't. On the other hand, in this situation, at least as Jesus tells the parable and where he's going with it, what's worthiness got to do with it, really? We spend a lot of our lives trying to be worthy. That's pretty typical of people all through history. And oftentimes we feel, I'm not worthy. I'm really not valued. I've been undercut. Any number of things, particularly in the business world or in your various relationships. And it's fairly typical. And the sad thing is, religious faith, whatever the religion, but also Christianity to a great degree, has been way too strongly on the side of emphasizing worthiness, even when not meaning to. Think of the idea that we've got to have the right beliefs. We've got to maintain the right actions. We've got to have the right morality. We've got to be totally dedicated. Because otherwise, God isn't really going to love us. You know, we're not worthy. And again, the answer is we're not worthy, but that isn't the point. That's the biggest gain that we got in the time of the Reformation with Martin Luther and John Calvin and the rest of those guys at that time, pretty much. The sense that we are saved by grace. Following actually what Paul says, of course, as you know, we are saved by grace, not by works. Rembrandt lived in Amsterdam at a time about 100 years after Calvin and Luther had been on the scene. And so he's imbued with that kind of language. He attends a Reformed church that would have been preached regularly. Now, unfortunately, the other side is they continued, even though they didn't mean to, they continued often to talk about, you've got to, now you've got to do this. Back to the worthiness side of it. And the catch is, this parable then really contains the entire gospel, doesn't it? The whole thing is right there. We are saved by God because God loves us. God has compassion on us. God wants us to be part of God's family forever. Always has wanted that, always will want that. So the son, when he finally comes home, he's now safe. He is now in his father's home again, and he can be relaxed once he's there. Well, that leads us to the second painting. So I'll ask Sandy to come back up, and we'll take a look at the one for which this actual session is named, The Return of the Prodigal Son.
Yes, this painting is very powerful, don't you think? So certainly one of my favorites. It was done in somewhere between 1660 and 1665, which is at the end of Rembrandt's life. The size of it is 8.5 feet by 6 and almost 7 feet wide. So it's big. It's very big. The other one was, slightly smaller, but not that much smaller. So the first Prodigal Son painting was done 25 to 30 years before this one. I wonder if Rembrandt planned to do this second one, because I think if in his understanding of, you know, this complicated story, it would be hard to tell the whole story in one painting. So he told part of it in early on, and then you wonder, did he plan it? We have no reason to think one way or the other, but my guess is he planned to eventually paint that one. Over the years, Rembrandt gained wisdom, having had a complicated personal life. I think it's safe to say that the sorrow of losing his wife and infant children, working through financial ups and downs, as Jim had alluded to, and producing a prodigious amount of art, gave him a different perspective as he painted this version of the prodigal son. So let's take a look at the painting. What you can see are, I'm actually going to refer to one down here so I don't have to turn all the time, but what you see are five figures in the foreground, and then up in the upper left-hand corner, it's hard to maybe see with this reproduction, but there is a kind of a casting of a figure up in the that left, well, your left-hand side. It's hard for me to know exactly what that might be. But let's concentrate on these five figures, okay? So there's the father, the returning younger son, the older son, who is the one standing on the far right. And we're going to say that the seated figure is a rich man. And then the other sort of more shadowed figure is likely a servant or slave. So let's start with the father. The father, his face, of course, has the look of compassion and love as he gazes at his returning son. And the father's hands are right in the middle, and that's what everybody is looking at, is that their gazes all point down to the way the father is embracing his returned son. Now take a look at those hands. Do you notice a difference between the two hands? Anybody? Yep. Seems bigger. Okay. Yeah. Let's put it in masculine, feminine. Do you happen to see that one hand looks more masculine and one hand looks more feminine? Okay. That is an intentional symbol, use of symbology for Rembrandt. So, you know, father, God, who is embracing with both the father, or the female, father and mother are embracing him. So he uses that that technique to kind of show us that God loves both as a father and a mother. The returning son. He is the lightest figure and the only one who clearly has nothing, not even shoes. The painting depicts the moment of his surrender to his father. And in my opinion, that's utter vulnerability. So let's shift over to the older brother. So he's standing to the right, and his face is highlighted. He's staring at his younger brother, and I do wonder what he is thinking. We have talked about the father's hands, but I also want to look at the older brother's hands. Do they match? If Rembrandt used the female-male components for the father's hands, do those, the older brother's hands match? I see one, to me, one is darker, one is lighter. Now, you could maybe attribute that to a shadow from his cloak, but I don't think so. I really do think that Rembrandt uses those, the hands as symbols, and the larger, darker hand that's wrapped around the lighter, smaller hand is maybe his nature. He has a darker nature that is, you know, that he's struggling with. He's holding, he's, you know, trying to deal with this situation. And so I think Rembrandt uses that symbol once again. Let's move to this, the rich man who is seated. We talked about that, Jim and I, and probably he's a friend or a financial advisor to the father. And I think his posture is really curious. He's got crossed arm and crossed legs. So it's a very complicated pose. And maybe that's Rembrandt's way of symbolizing a mixed reaction to this young son's return. He's kind of, you know, all knotted up about it. So the rich man's arm is over his heart. And that might suggest either a guardedness or, you know, some, I don't know, we could have a seminar about body language, but I think that this one is complicated. So then we move on to the fifth person, who is the servant. And the text speaks of a servant who tells the older brother that his young brother has returned. And we're kind of assuming that this is the servant. So would that be, I don't know. I find that to be kind of my entrance into this, the everyman who is observing what the father is doing for the son. Any other thoughts? Okay, well, Chip?
Face is so white.
So white?
White.
White. Well, that's a classic way of painting to bring emphasis to those the areas that you want to you know, highlight. That's what they are. Is so yeah, he just Rembrandt wants you to look at the father. Look at the hands. So the father's, you know, he's that unit right there is literally one design element, is the father son combined. That's one design element. Then the other design elements, but I think it's the importance, in a word, the importance of what it is that he wants to highlight.
Rich man to the right, but his older son is not in the picture.
No,
is the rich man then?
The older son is the one on the right.
And
the younger son, the returning son, is the kneeling one.
And the rich man's sitting then?
And then the rich man is sitting there. Yeah, yeah. So we know that basically by his dress. We don't really see the dress of what I determined is the servant. Some people think of that as the mother, but I don't know. I think she would be dressed more, with more affluently, and so.
And an older face.
And an older face. Yes, exactly.
Do we have any commentary from Rembrandt on any of these paintings?
No, we don't. The mother had died. It's possible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The one way up in the left you're talking about? Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Family said private chaplain. That may be.
That's possible that it's the a chapel. That sounds very plausible. All right. Well, Jim, one more? Yeah, John. No, it is not. That is not a self-portrait. No. By that point, I guess Rembrandt, if you look at it, take a little time to look at the 90-some self-portraits that Rembrandt did over the course of his life. And you'll start to really, note his face. And I would pretty much say no. That is not.
Charlotte had a real quick question.
Oh, yeah, Charlotte. It's okay. Sandy, one of the things that strikes me about that painting is that it's as if there are two pictures within the painting. I think about the son and the father, and then you see the larger. It's almost like a micro and a macro. And if that highlight wasn't on that older son, you really would have them all sort of blending into the background, with the other two, the father and the son, really standing out.
I agree. The design for me is, somewhat diagonal, but try to picture not having that seated figure there and it doesn't work. Or try to see the painting without the servant. It doesn't work. And then, of course, I think in this picture, granted, it's not necessarily in the text, but Rembrandt brings the older son into the picture because it's such an important part of his painting. He can tell the story better by bringing that older brother into it. So, okay.
Thanks. Can I say something?
Can I stop you?
Yeah, I'm thinking of a very current parallel to this whole theme of the prodigal son. The book about the great de-churching that talks about how over the last 25 years, 40 million people have left the Christian churches, evangelical mainline, and so forth. But then thinking, if the people who left are to come back, let's say, consider them the prodigal son, would there be a receptive attitude like the father? Would there be an attitude of the older son saying, well, we've been good Christians all this time, and now these people want to come back. Should we welcome them back? I mean, I think that's a modern parallel to the whole prodigal son theme that Jesus spoke of. So I just throw that out.
Thank you. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And let's hope that as things change and people do come back, because I do believe that's going to happen at some point, that we in the church at that time will not be older brothers in our response, which we need to read, actually, the part about the older brother, right? On the back. So let me put all the papers we've got up here. Let me see if I can find it. Um, Now, his elder son was in the field, and as he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. He called one of the slaves and asked what was going on. And he replied, "Your brother has come, and your father has killed a fatted calf because he got him back safe and sound." Then he became angry, and he refused to go in. His father came out and began to plead with him. But he answered his father, "Listen, for all these years I have been working like a slave for you, and I've never disobeyed your command. Yet you have never given me even a goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came back, who has devoured your assets with prostitutes, you killed a fatted calf for him." Then the father said to him, "Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate. We had to rejoice, because this brother of yours was dead and has come to life. He was lost and has been found." You notice that Rembrandt has taken some liberties here in the way he did paint it, because where is the older son at this point? He's out in the field, right? And he won't go into the house. So what does the father do? The father goes out. Yeah, the father goes out to find him. Before we talk about that anymore, though, I want to add one more thing related to all of this. And again, give the feeling that this older son is going to have when he does get there. From the painting, the way the arms and the hands surround the father is surrounding the young son. It's almost like his robe is over him, protecting him. And that reminds me of an image that's in the Old Testament a lot, numbers of times, about an eagle guarding its young, its chicks, so to speak, in the nest. Psalm 91, famous psalm, has what's probably the most famous words about that. And it goes, "You who live in the shelter of the Most High, who abide in the shadow of the Almighty, will say to the Lord, 'My refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust.' He will cover you with his pinions." In case you don't know what pinions are, it seems to be the end of the wing that has the feathers for flying, whatever that means exactly. Not being a biologist, I don't understand that completely. "He will cover you with his pinions, and under his wings you will find refuge." So the younger son now has found refuge. The older son, though, is still outside. But the father now comes to him to try to speak to him. I think when you look at the painting, you see that rigidity, too, of this older son, the way he's standing there. And his hands, as Sandy said, they're folded. And it's all like he's holding himself in. He really does not want to open his arms to put them around that brother of his. He simply wants to not to have to deal with this. Thought the kid was gone, but he's come back. The other thing I think it's fair to say is, can you really blame him if you think about it? Or maybe to put it differently, to put it into our context and something that might relate to us, would you forgive that younger son if he came back to you like that? Would I do that? Isn't it possible that we're really close to that older brother to start with? Kind of like John was suggesting about how churches might operate with other people coming to them. Aren't we really sometimes awfully close to that? And aren't there people that we dislike and want nothing to do with? These days, you could very readily probably say that about any number of politicians on one side or another. oh, I wish that person weren't around. But it applies and probably has applied to one or another people in your life. It certainly hasn't mine. And I think I shouldn't think that. But it is, it kind of goes with us pretty readily. And don't, if you feel that way, don't you also feel, I want that person to get what they deserve? They get away with too much. They did something harmful to me or in general. They should get what's coming to them. We want revenge, basically. And wouldn't that be more what this older brother is thinking himself? In fact, how many movies and books have you seen, in general, stories in our culture about someone who's righteous, who's going to go track down that evil person who did something or other terrible? And whose side are we on in that movie or book always? It's the person who goes out and is going to get even. And one way or another probably kills that person, as most of those stories tend to go. Getting vengeance. But remember what the gospel says. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I will repay. And how does God take vengeance? He sends his son to the cross. He does the same sort of thing that he's doing here with the younger son. He's therefore inviting that person back by means of Christ. So I actually wonder, although in a way I don't wonder, what the reaction of that son would be, this particular son in this situation, if he were to hear Jesus reply when Jesus is on the cross, and the one thief says to him, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And what's Jesus saying? Today, you'll be with me in paradise. That's a parallel, actually, to this prodigal son, the reaction that happens here. But do remember, it's also true that forgiveness doesn't just, and acceptance doesn't just mean that everything is fine. There's going to be other things related to it. For instance, you can forgive the person, but it doesn't take away all the consequences that have occurred or might continue to occur. For example, living a dissolute life for some period of time is going to have an effect on you, right? For the rest of your life. You might change, you might get over it, but there's probably going to be after effects. And this younger son that we're looking at in the parable, he has lost his inheritance. That's not coming back. So it's not like he escapes everything. It's not just like it's a get out of jail free card, in a sense, to forgive. And on top of that, forgiveness only works if the person is repentant, realizes guilt, wants to be forgiven. That's part of what the South African brilliant, I keep forgetting how you say that, the conference on reconciliation. Does anybody remember the exact title for that whole program that they had after apartheid? But that's the point. There's got to be, on the side of the guilty party, there's got to be a recognition of it. So forgiveness isn't regardless. I'm sorry? I can't hear you. Of the AA program? Okay, reconciliation. Oh, great. Okay. Thank you. That's a good example. Get a mic.
As you were commenting, what came to mind was the difference between some of the Christian approaches and some of those in the Islamic ones, where an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is pretty much the standard. That's not true all the way through, but it's a real contrast.
It is.
And it makes for interesting intercultural conversations.
Yeah, that's a major difference that, I mean, obviously, it's taught in the Old Testament, but Jesus came and brought to fulfillment in his own life, God becoming human and so forth. I just realized how far we've gone with the time, so let me try to conclude here. The interesting thing is to remember that this whole parable is a setup, because Jesus has already told two parables in Luke 15. The one is about a lost sheep and then a lost coin. And in both cases, suggesting that the person will go out and seek those things, and that's a good thing. So he's got the audience thinking, yeah, of course. And then he says there was there were two sons, and one of them disappeared. And now the father is going to seek him. Well, and that's where things stop for the hearers, because Jesus has been talking to those who are called tax collectors and sinners, the riffraff, so to speak, from the perspective of the rabbis and the Pharisees and Sanhedrin and all of that. And so they don't deserve anything. It's Sanhedrin and particularly the Pharisees who are the good folks, because they try to do God's will. And they're looking on and they're grumbling. He receives those kind of people. We're not like them. So obviously the second piece of the parable that we just read about the older son coming back and not really wanting to come back is a direct reference to them and their reactions. But notice how it ends. Jesus doesn't say what happens at the end of this parable. Actually, and this is where it doesn't quite work with the painting, does that older son come in or doesn't he? And isn't that where the hands suggest hanging on, as Sandy was saying? But he's partially in the light and he's partially in the dark. So the final question would be, and you can take this home with you to think about, does that son now move into the light? Or does he go backwards into the darkness totally? He's only partially lit. He's close, but what will he do? Yeah, he's very erect and he doesn't show any desire to go that way, but it's almost like maybe he's got to, because the way the parable, the father responds is, but we had to celebrate and rejoice. He's still talking to him, because this brother of yours was dead. When the son complains, he says, this son of yours. And now he turns it around and he says, this brother of yours. The parable is phenomenal. So is Rembrandt's paintings, and we're out of time. So thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Yeah, thanks, David. Thank you.